So I'm going to talk about adaptation in an infinitesimal world, and if I can find the arrows, the arrow doesn't work.
Okay.
Good. So I'm going to contrast two paradigms, two apparently very different ways of looking at the world. One characteristic of studies of long-term molecular evolution, where we think of evolution as consisting of successive substitutions and mutations. They appear, they may be lost, they may be fixed, next one appears, etc. Or we think in terms of quantitative genetics, in which traits have a complicated genetic basis, they have a more or less normal distribution of values in a population, and the mean value of the distribution changes in proportion to the selection gradient and the additive genetic variance of the trait. So one, a long-term perspective in which evolution occurs in jump substitutions, the other, a continuous process of change of mean and possibly variance of traits. So what I want to do in this talk is to, first of all, show that actually these two different ways of looking at things are connected, that they can both be subsumed under the so-called infinitesimal model, and that in some way adaptation is most efficient under this infinitesimal regime. So I'll start by just showing a very, very simple example in which we just have an additive trait under directional selection. We have a population of N diploid individuals. We have a whole lot of loci with mutation rates mu. And the effects of alleles at those loci are gamma i. So the rate of increase of the mean is proportional to the number of mutations coming in per generation times the probability of fixation of each one of those, which is basically twice the selection coefficient. The selection coefficient is the selection gradient on the trait times the effect of that allele on the trait. So that's this fixation probability. And then we multiply by the effect, etc. And we end up with this little formula, which is the rate of advance. But we can get to the same formula by looking at the phenotypic level, looking at the rate of change of the mean is the genetic variance times the selection gradient. That, in turn, is given by this formula. If we think of a balance between mutation putting in variance at a rate Vm, random drift removing it at rate 1 over 2ne, we get to an equilibrium between drift and mutation, giving a genetic variance 2ne Vm. And that, when we work through it, gives us the same formula, fortunately. So we can get to exactly the same formula, either by thinking of mutations coming in and fixing with some probability, or in terms of the standard quantitative genetic approach. We can do the same thing if we think about stabilizing selection towards an optimal. I won't go through the details, but if we think of some sort of Gaussian stabilizing selection where the fitness of an individual decreases with distance from the optimum, with a sort of region over which there's reasonably high fitness defined by Vs, a sort of inverse measure of selection. We could think of a multivariate extension of that rather easily. One can easily show that the variance of the mean, as it fluctuates around the optimal value, is given by Vs over the effective population size, or twice the effective size, independent, in fact, of the genetic variance. And that's simply a balance between random fluctuations in the mean due to drift and a restoring force pulling the mean back towards the optimum. And one could derive that in a number of ways, either by looking at fluctuations in the mean at the phenotypic level, as here, or looking at probabilities of substitution, saying that if a population is at a point some way from the optimum, it's more likely that alleles will, that mutations will fix if they bring the population towards the optimum. And in fact, one can perhaps see this most generally using Wright's formula, which gives the distribution of allele frequencies under arbitrary selection, as long as we can assume linkage equilibrium. And the distribution, the joint distribution of allele frequencies is a product of terms, basically the neutral distribution under mutation and drift, times W bar to the 2NE, which will be a Gaussian-type formula. And we can sort of, well, yeah, I'd like you to imagine this. I know you haven't had coffee yet, but perhaps you can imagine a 1,000 or a million dimensional hypercube, and then you can kind of squash this hypercube or represent it in terms of trait space. So we have, let's say, all minus alleles here, all plus alleles here, and in between we have a range in which the trait is somehow close to the optimum. So populations will still have an enormous number of genotypes that will satisfy that constraint, and they'll hop from one point to another point. And if, as is likely often the case, 4n mu is less than 1, is small, then populations will typically be near to a fixed state, and they will follow this distribution, jumping from the corners of this sort of hypercube, but always remaining near the optimum. And in fact, one can then sort of transform that and just think in terms of the distribution of the trait mean, project this very high dimensional space down to the distribution of the trait mean, and we simply have the neutral distribution of the trait mean times this w bar to the 2ne. And if we imagine that in the absence of selection, there's a very broad distribution of mean values, that the range of possible means that we could achieve with just a neutral model would be very broad, then one finds that, in fact, regardless of the genetic basis, it doesn't even have to be an additive trait, we find that the realised distribution of the population around the optimum is dominated by this W bar to the 2NE, which immediately leads back to this. So this is actually a very general formula that we can achieve either by thinking of substitutions, hopping from fixed state to fixed state, or in terms of a quantitative genetic model. Okay, so let's check time. Very complicated this. Okay, so this sort of description, just saying that, you know, the molecular evolution substitution view of things, the quantitative genetic view of things are more or less equivalent. The quantitative genetics is kind of a beautiful set of machinery, but it doesn't get you very far, because although we know how the mean changes, we don't really know how the genetic variance changes. And in explicit population genetic models, it's really, really hard to get any kind of useful approximation. But there's an extraordinarily successful model called the infinitesimal model, which actually allows one to say a remarkable amount without knowing anything about individual genes or about the genetic basis of the trait very much. Now, the term infinitesimal model is often associated with Fisher, and if you read Fisher 1918, you can sort of see the infinitesimal model in there. He never uses the term infinitesimal. No one seems to know where the term comes from. I asked Bill Hill and Michael Bulmer, and they said, well, that's what it's called, and we can't remember where the word came from. The model was stated, in fact, all the way back, long before the rediscovery of Mendel's work. It was stated by Galton in a paper in Nature in 1877, describing some crosses he did on between two strains of sweet pea with small seeds and big seeds. And he said, I was certainly astonished to find the family variability of the produce of the little seeds to be equal to that of the big ones. But so it was, and I thankfully accept the fact. For if it had been otherwise, I cannot imagine from theoretical considerations how the problem could have been solved. So he was saying that, you know, luckily it seemed that the variance amongst offspring was independent of whether the parents had large or small or whatever seed size. In fact, he went on to use then this model to calculate the equilibrium variance under stabilising selection, which was a calculation that was next done by Bulmer in the 1970s. So it's sort of remarkable that way before classical genetics, the sort of understanding of Mendel's rules and the development of population genetics, Galton actually used this rather simple model in which we simply say that two parents mate, produce offspring, and there's a segregation variant. The offspring have a genetic value which varies in a normal distribution, independent of the parents' values. In fact, one can sort of extend this infinitesimal model and state it a bit more generally by saying that if we have a pedigree with a number of ancestors, the distribution of traits across that pedigree is multivariate normal with a covariance given by the rules of quantitative genetics. And therefore, if we condition on the values of the individuals, then we clearly alter the means of the offspring. That's what selection does, but we don't alter the variance and the covariance of the structure. And that's a consequence of multivariate normality. In fact, all of this is really a kind of central limit theorem, which gives it, you know, some degree of generality, more than the usual understanding, which is that the infinitesimal model requires strict additivity. So I'll say a little bit about that. Okay, so we have this infinitesimal model. We can use it to drive all sorts of things. One of the most interesting applications was developed by Alan Robertson in the 60s. And Robertson's derivation of this result on how far one can ultimately get with directional selection acting on standing variation, this derivation, Robertson did in a way that shows something rather fundamental about the way the infinitesimal model works. So one can derive this result by simply saying, well, the change in mean is equal to the selection gradient times the sum of the additive variances over all the generations. The additive variance will decrease through inbreeding at a rate 1 over 2n for diploids. And therefore, the total response the ultimate change in mean over a very large number of generations until variation is exhausted is 2n times the change in the first generation. So this is a very straightforward thing to derive. Robertson derived it by another more complicated but rather interesting route. He pointed out that the change in mean is equal to the sum of the effects of each allele times the difference between the fixation probability of the allele, which will be elevated by selection, minus the initial allele frequency. If there's no selection, the fixation probability is just equal to the initial frequency. So this is the standard Kimura formula. An allele present to 5% with no selection has a 5% chance of fixation. Positive selection, NS larger, increases fixation probability. So working through this, Robertson showed that if we have weak selection in terms of NS small, approximately this gradient here is given by this formula, we work through, and we get the Robertson limit. So what this is showing is that the infinitesimal model here, which says that the variance is unaffected by selection, simply decays due to drift, due to inbreeding, that is equivalent to assuming weak selection in the sense that drift dominates selection on individual alleles. So that's the underlying assumption. It's saying not that there are small changes of allele frequency. People often say, oh, well, under the infinitesimal model, there are only small changes of allele frequency. That's not the case. What is the case is that the distribution of allele frequency changes is perturbed very little by selection. So there may be fixations. Ultimately, there have to be fixations. But the rate of those fixations, the probability of those fixations, is not affected very much by selection. Okay, so a little diversion here. Robertson derived this ultimate limit, this ultimate change in mean, if we keep selecting on a set of standard variation. And we can ask, well, you know, can we do better than this limit? Suppose we had alleles not of small effect, NS small, we had alleles of larger effect. Would we get further? And when we do that calculation, we say for a given genetic variance, a given V naught, we can calculate the expected advance. And you find that actually, if you start with rare alleles, this is the initial frequency of the alleles that are coming in. The different colors represent different strengths of total selection, but particularly with strong selection, you can more or less double the ultimate response by starting with rare alleles of large effect. However, that's misleading because, if you like, you have to know which way direction is pointing. If you say you don't know a priori whether direction is going to go in this direction or that direction, in effect, if you assume that the distribution of initial allele frequencies is symmetrical, you don't know which is the plus and the minus allele, if you average over those two, you end up with actually very, very little deviation from the Robertson limit. And to the extent that you do get a deviation, when you have very strong selection, you get a deviation, you do worse. So in the sense I've chosen, if you're not allowed to choose the direction of selection in advance, the best you can do is to have infinitesimal variation. Then the allele frequencies don't matter. All that matters is the total genetic variance. And we're in this infinitesimal regime. Okay. So we can make various extensions to the infinitesimal. I won't say much about this in the interest of time, but basically you can include epistasis rather easily. You basically have to follow not just the breeding value, the additive genetic value of an individual, but the components due to the additive by additive, etc. You divide the individual's genetic value into components due to the marginal effect of alleles, pairwise interactions, three-way interactions. You can show still that the distribution of trait values on the pedigree is multivariate normal, in provided you have some assumptions which are not too stringent on the nature of epistasis. And you find then that selection, again, hardly perturbs the variance components away from the values you would get using the standard neutral quantitative genetic machinery. And one can apply that to extend Robertson's limit to include arbitrary epistasis. And this work with Thiago Paisal. For haploids, you get essentially the same result with the additive variance replaced by the genotypic variance. Non-additive, the epistatic components get converted into additive variants, which then contributes to the selection response. But the total maximum effect is still constrained by the total genotypic variance. For diploids, you do get an inflation to the extent that you have higher order epistasis. However, it's quite hard to come up with any plausible model which produces large fractions of genetic variance due to these higher order effects. So I suspect that this is not, you know, a very large gain, if you like, in efficiency. another extension to the infinitesimal, again, proposed by Alan Robertson in the 70s, but not much looked at since, is to include linkage, to say that instead of having a large number of unlinked variants, we actually have very large numbers of variants affecting a trait scattered evenly over the genome. You know, as we've seen in the previous two talks, it seems to be the case for many complex traits. And this is a model which has been developed by a couple of papers in genetics by Himani Shachdeva, who's a postdoc with me. And just to very briefly describe this, it actually has rather counterintuitive consequences. Suppose we imagine putting a particular genome into a homogeneous population, and this genome is described by adding up the effects of all of the little infinitesimal contributions as we move along. So this is simply a Brownian path, a random Brownian random walk. And the steepness tells us the density of plus effect. So if we took a block of genome from here to here, this green block, it would have an effect given by the difference between these two values. That's it. So steep positive slopes mean a region that by chance has a positive effect, steep negative slope, a region that by chance has a negative effect. We can describe the rates of increase of any block defined by the left-hand end and the right-hand end. So this is all possible blocks we can choose from this chromosome. And there'll be some blocks which have a positive rate of increase, which will actually increase exponentially despite recombination, as long as the selective effect they have is greater than the rate of recombination. And so what we'll see is something that looks very much like a sweep. So this would be simulation with a single locus of a certain effect given by this sort of green block, or a block that has an infinite number of contributions but is increasing because selection is outweighing recombination, is increasing intact. There'll be a reduction in diversity over a wider region. In principle, this looks different. If you add up over replicates, you get a clear difference. In any one replicate, it's probably pretty hard to distinguish between a sweep due to a single locus and a sweep due to a block of genome that has a whole lot of stuff in it that has a net positive effect. Okay. So just to make brief contact with the real world, just to mention some work I've been doing with Frank Chan in Tübingen on a Longshanks selection experiment done by Campbell Rolian in Calgary. And this was simply a selection experiment on two lines of mice, 30 mice each generation, 20 generations, selecting simply for longest legs. Every generation, you take the 20% of mice with the longest legs. That's it. So you know exactly what selection's going on. You've got the pedigree. You want to know, given the gene sequences, given the pedigree, can you find the genes responsible for increasing their legs by three or four standard deviations? And what's a bit sobering is if you simulate the infinitesimal model with linkage, you throw down a very, very large number of loci with random effects to match the actual known heritability, and you then select, you get the observed selection response, all that works. You look at the distribution of allele frequencies under the diffusion approximation, under a real neutral simulation, blue and black, compare it with the simulations with selection, with strong selection, as in the experiment, and you get tiny differences. You get a tiny excess. You start with one copy at the beginning out of total number of genomes. You get a little excess of sweeps up to, let's say, 50%. This difference in red and blue, red and black, is really very small. And for common polymorphisms, there's virtually no effect of this strong selection on the allele frequency distribution. And that suggests that it's going to be hard to find major loci, if indeed we are in this infinitesimal regime. So, in fact, in this experiment, somewhat to my disappointment, because I like the infinitesimal world, but Frank doesn't, so he found some genes. You just take a window, you look at some statistic like the mean square change in arcsine and transformed allele frequency, whatever, and you look for windows that have a big signal in both one and other replicates. So plot the two replicants against each other, and you get these clear outliers, and they make sense, and there are some genes, and then Frank's done all sorts of fancy transgenics to show that these really are regulatory elements which affect leg length. So there are maybe two loci which are clearly significant, which stand out in both replicates. There are maybe six others which stand out in one or other of them. But the rest is kind of, I think, an infinitesimal background that, you know, may well remain unresolved. Of course, in this experiment, it's a very small experiment, but I think it's still true that in a large experiment even, you would be very, very hard pushed to find in these kind of selection experiments which regions are actually responsible for selection change. So finally, wind up by just asking, do organisms live in an infinitesimal world? I've tried to argue that it would be good if they did, partly because there wouldn't be all these pesky individual genes we'd have to go and spend lots of time and effort looking for, but also because adaptation would be optimal in some sense. Okay. That in some ways, given a certain genetic variance, you maximise your selection response if these effects are spread evenly over the genome. And in fact, this infinitesimal view of things is the basis for classical quantitative genetics and animal breeding and so on. And it works really well. Just a nice review by Weber and Diggins looking at a whole range of experiments in mice and flies and maize and so on, a whole lot of different experiments, asking what is the ratio between the change over 50 generations and the change in the first generation. These curves here are the kind of Robertson limit, including a bit of mutation or not, doesn't make much difference. The actual observations pretty much follow that curve. They're a bit lower. Maybe that's a bit of an effect of selection. Maybe it's an effect of linkage, actually. Overall, it seems that over 50, 100 generations, the infinitesimal works pretty well. Now, I'm interested more in long-term evolutionary processes. We can look at human genetics, and there we know that there have been all kinds of adaptations to our dispersal to live in all kinds of different extreme latitudes, on different diets, etc., etc., different altitudes. But there are rather few cases where we can identify particular genes which leave a clear signature in the genome. Most human adaptation, I'd argue, has not led to an obvious trace in the genome. So these two lines suggest, maybe we're in this infinitesimal regime. On the other hand, if we look at the mutational variance relative to the genetic variance, which gives an estimate of the kind of persistence time of alleles of the order of 1,000 or less generations, that implies that alleles responsible for quantitative traits are under strong selection, and sorts of indirect molecular evolution arguments suggest that most non-synonymous mutations do have NS substantially larger than 1. So I'm not really going to propose that we're in this infinitesimal world, but I am going to propose that we need to take it seriously, at least as a null model, which we may find it quite difficult to reject in either GWAS or in this kind of artificial selection experiments. Thank you.